slowly through Saturday morning, a drier interlude, then some further outbreaks of rain heading in. But the afternoon looks a little bit drier, if somewhat cloudy and cool too, 12 degrees in Newcastle at best. Sunday's forecast, sunshine and showers for England and Wales, fairly gloomy and damp in the far northeast, but the best of the sunshine once again for Northern Ireland. It's back to you, Steve.
Thank you, Sarah. This is BBC Radio 4. So now, in The Land Where Lemons Grow, the author Helena Attlee journeys through Italy, exploring the country's love of citrus fruit. Today she heads south to Calabria in search of the world's most valuable citrus fruit, bergamot. The reader is Francesca Diamond.
Calabria is bounded on its west side by the Ionian Sea and on its east by the Tyrrhenian Sea. Its southernmost tip almost touches Sicily across the Strait of Messina, and the Apennines stride down its centre, dividing east from west. Mountains have always cut the region off from itself. You only have to read Edward Lear's account of walking through Calabria in the mid-19th century to get an impression of the difficulty of the terrain. Lear is best known today for his nonsense poems, and yet he was also an intrepid traveller and the author of vividly descriptive illustrated travel journals. The first challenge would have been the extreme gradients of the landscape. In winter, ferocious torrents descend from the mountains, cutting villages off from one another. In summer, the deep channels that they gouge from the land would have been a formidable obstacle. Lear describes these dry torrent beds as lonely places of devastation, blinding in their white or sandy brilliancy, barring all from view without their high cliff sides. This harsh and beautiful landscape, beset by extreme weather conditions, is home to the most valuable citrus fruit in the world. Bergamot is the product of a natural cross-pollination between a lemon tree and a sour orange that occurred in Calabria in the mid-17th century. Essential oil can be extracted from the bergamot's fruit, and ever since the beginning of the 18th century has been used as a fixing agent in the perfume industry. The oil makes a perfume last longer and brings all its other elements into harmony, rather like the conductor of an orchestra. Although its extremely high value has inspired many attempts to grow it elsewhere, bergamot is like an animal in its chosen territory. It thrives and fruits successfully only on a thin strip of coastline that runs for 75 kilometres from Villa San Giovanni on the Tyrrhenian coast to Brancaleone on the shores of the Ionian Sea. Here the tree grows tall and strong and bears such heavy crops that its brittle branches often snap under the weight of oily fruit. Trees are pruned very lightly, only once a year, and some of them grow to over 4 metres high. They are carefree, liberated, untidy and entirely organic, the hippies of the citrus world. Take it away from its home ground, however, and you make it a perpetual invalid, incapable of tolerating the cold or weathering strong winds. The history of bergamot is intimately connected to the life of Giovanni Maria Farina, born in Piedmont in northern Italy in 1685. Farina's grandmother came from a long tradition of perfume making, and by the time Giovanni Maria was 14, she had already noticed that he divides people into those who smell good and those who smell bad. Life will not be easy for him, but his nose is as quick as his mind. He proved exceptionally skilled at the art of distillation and of combining alcohol with fragrances extracted from fruit and blossom. As a young man, Farina emigrated to Germany to pursue his profession. In 1708, when he was only 23 years old, he invented a bergamot-based perfume. He named it Eau de Cologne, in honour of the city where he lived. For Giovanni Maria, this was the smell of home. For his northern European customers, the perfume conveyed the exotic essence of everything they yearned for in the sunny south. Its middle and base notes combined with the wearer's skin to produce an individual scent for every person who wore it. Eau de Cologne was a huge commercial success and an international bestseller. It became the perfume of the great houses and royal courts of 18th century Europe. It might have been the first thing you noticed when meeting King Louis XV, Napoleon Bonaparte, or Mozart. And if you had visited Goethe, that great lover of southern Italy and its citrus trees, you would have found him writing beside a box of rags soaked in the stuff. The skin of bergamot is so full of oil that it will begin to seep out at the slightest pressure. So initially it was extracted simply by pressing and turning the peel of the fruit against a sponge. The sponge was then squeezed into a glass phial, and the liquid was left to settle and separate. The oil produced by this traditional method is unrivaled, and according to one nose in the perfume industry, the difference between it and oil extracted mechanically is just the same as the difference between a bull and a bullock. Bergamot oil combines 368 separate chemical components. Ever since the 19th century, it has been used to give a distinctive aroma and flavour to one of the most popular teas in the world, Earl Grey, a blend of dark China teas treated with the bergamot oil or peel. It is always said to have been named after the second Earl Grey of Howick, Britain's Prime Minister from 1830 to 1834. The story revolves around a diplomatic mission to China when Grey is supposed to have rescued the son of a Chinese mandarin from drowning. The mandarin was said to have been so grateful that he sent a box of bergamot-scented China tea to Grey in London. There are several things in this story that don't add up, not least that Grey never set foot in China and bergamot grew only in Calabria. Nevertheless, it is certain that the English developed a taste for scented teas at about this time, blending Indian and Sri Lankan leaves, dousing them with oil of bergamot, and naming the mixture Earl Grey in honour of their Prime Minister. Its traditional role in the perfume and tea industries is ongoing, but bergamot oil's antiseptic and antibacterial qualities mean that it is also used in hospitals all over the world as a disinfectant to combat superbugs and post-operative infection, and in dentistry, ophthalmic surgery, gynecology and dermatology. These qualities were first discovered by a local doctor called Francesco Calabro in the early 19th century. He was often called on to treat the workers employed to extract essential oil from the skins of bergamot. In those days, the fruit was peeled with a razor-sharp, broad-bladed knife, and despite protection, the workers often cut themselves. Yet Calabro was fascinated to observe that these cuts never became septic and that they healed extraordinarily fast. From this empirical evidence, Calabro deduced that the oil itself had antiseptic and healing properties. Later, Ferdinando Bergamo, an army doctor in Reggio Calabria, experimented with the oil as both a preventative and a cure for scabies that was endemic among soldiers billeted nearby. His approach consisted simply of rubbing a mixture of bergamot and almond oils all over the body at regular intervals. Diluting the bergamot with almond oil prevented it from irritating the tender skin of the younger soldiers. Bergamo's system replaced an ineffective and very much more complex treatment involving a sulphur bath, which did nothing for the quality of the air in the barracks or the condition of the soldiers' skin. As I drove into Calabria's bergamot belt, a brisk wind off the sea made palm trees in the streets of Villa San Giovanni thrash about against grey clouds. I noticed an enormous hoarding advertising Degustazione dei prodotti tipici e al bergamotto, an entire building devoted to tasting local food and products flavoured with bergamot. At first sight, the degusteria looked like little more than a lean-to, its doors and windows festooned in padlocks. "Does the degusteria ever open?" I asked a newsagent on the other side of the road. "Always," was the reply. And almost at once a car drew up outside and the place sprang into life. I was beside the door as the padlocks came off. "I'm forming a queue, signora," I said, as she fumbled through a huge bunch of keys. By the time the door was open, I already knew that she was called Sophie. I explained my interest in bergamot, and her face lit up. "Allora, ci sciogliamo," she said. And when I asked what it meant, she paused for a moment and then replied, "You know how it feels when you lie down in the sun? Well, you might say, che sciallo." She accompanied the word with an enormous and contented sigh. I liked this promise of indulgence and relaxation, and so I was glad to sit down at a small metal table inside the door. Bergamot is so acidic in its natural form that cooks ignored it for many centuries, and it was even categorised as a toxic substance. In recent times, Ezio Pizzi, president of Unionberg, a bergamot producers organisation, fought for 6 years to have the toxic label removed. Eventually, he managed to persuade the Department of Health to have the fruit and its peel analysed, and as a result, the label has been suspended. I was glad to know that when Sophie returned to my table with fresh bread, cubes of local cheese and small dishes of bergamot marmalade, a jam made from Calabria's finest red onions, grown in Tropea on the Tyrrhenian coast, an angry jam made from local chilies and a glass of bergamot cordial to wash it all down. Then came figs and round chilies, all of them suspended in an amber haze of bergamot syrup. I took things slowly, trying as I ate to put words around the taste of bergamot. Citrus was there, fresh, powerful and distinctive, but it was overlaid with bergamot's own unmistakable and startlingly intense incense-like flavour. In Bova, a small town close to the tip of Italy, a family of the same name has been extracting bergamot oil for 4 generations. Annunziato Bova had already stopped work for the day, but the scent of bergamot still hung in the air. The shining metal machinery was as clean as a Swiss laboratory, and Bova's young son was engaging with the family business by using the polished fruit hopper as a slide. The oil that dripped from a narrow pipe after that day's extraction was shiny and dark. This was green gold, the most valuable oil of all, and it would be used only in the highly lucrative context of the perfume industry. By the time the harvest ended in December, the fruit would have turned yellow, and the golden oil extracted from it would be good only for flavouring cakes and confectionery. But whether a harvest is at its beginning or its end, extraction is always a painfully slow process, and 100 kilos of fresh fruit make only 500 grams of essential oil. Immediately after extraction, the oil is stored in barrels in the small room on the other side of the narrow yard. Bova dipped an enormous pipette into a barrel and drew out just enough dark green oil to fill a small bottle. Like a sommelier with a glassful of something especially fine, he lifted it to his nose and inhaled deeply. "This is a good year," he said. "A very good year." It was time for my first experience of bergamot oil. I couldn't make comparisons, but what I smelt was wonderful. It had the brightness and clarity of sunshine, overlaid with a deep incense-like quality. It was the essence of citrus, and yet it didn't resemble the scent of the lemons or sour oranges that are its ancestors. Giorgio Gallesio, the early 19th century citrus expert, had his own explanation for the individuality of bergamot's magnificent scent. He said, "We are now convinced that, with the same principles differently combined, nature diversifies greatly her products, and consequently, it is very probable that the combination of the odorous principles of the lemon with those of the orange may give a result still more exquisite than either alone." We stood for a moment in silence before Bova turned to me and said, "I'm really, really proud of what I do." And then, gloriously, unexpectedly, he pressed that precious bottle of green gold into my hand.
Francesca Diamond was reading The Land Where Lemons Grow by Helena Attlee. The book was abridged by Lawrence Waring and produced by Kirstine Cameron. Now, we're off to sea. Thank you. This is BBC Radio 4. And now the shipping forecast issued by the Met Office on behalf of the Maritime and Coast Guard Agency at 0015 on Saturday the 26th of April. There are warnings of gales in Portland, Plymouth, Biscay, Fitzroy, Seoul, Lundy, Fastnet and Shannon. The general synopsis at 1800, low, Shannon 982, expected Fastnet 989 by 1800 Saturday. The area forecasts for the next 24 hours, west Viking, easterly 5 or 6, decreasing 4, showers good. East Viking, north at Zira, northeasterly 4 or 5, fair, good. South at Zira, northeast 40s, mainly easterly 5 to 7, showers moderate or good. Southwest 40s, Cromarty 4th, easterly 5 to 7, decreasing 4. Occasional rain, fog patches, moderate or good, becoming moderate or poor, occasionally very poor. Tyne.